We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about what we have learned in recent years using genetic science about human origins. Now, one of the things that we do know pretty much for sure, is that the human species did indeed begin in Africa, although there are a number of intriguing questions we'd still like to have answers for, like when exactly do modern humans appear, and where specifically on the African continent? And then from there, questions about why, when, and how they moved out from Africa and eventually spread out to populate the rest of the world. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with someone who is involved in an effort to try to get some answers to these questions. Our guest is Spencer Wells. He is a population geneticist. He's also an anthropologist. He is explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, and he is also leader of the Genographic Project. This is something that involves the National Geographic Society, IBM, and the Wyatt Family Foundation. It got underway in 2005, and it has been involved in collecting and analyzing DNA samples from people all over the world. And the ultimate effort is indeed to get an idea about how it is that human beings started out and moved out into the world. He is the author of a couple of books that explore this sort of territory. He wrote the book, The Journey of Man, A Genetic Odyssey, to look at and explain what genetic science tells us about human origins. He also wrote and presented a PBS National Geographic documentary of the same name on that subject. Since 2005, he's headed the Genographic Project. His other books include something a little bit more recent, Deep Ancestry, Inside the Genographic Project, published in 2006, and he has a new book that will be coming out probably within the next few months. The title of that book is Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. As we talk this morning with Spencer Wells, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455, if you'd like to call in. We do also have a toll-free line, so use that one if it would be long distance, 800-222-9455. We do also have an email, and you can send along your comments and questions that way. Will-talk, that's pretty much like it looks, W-I-L-L-talk, will-talk@illinois.edu. And any way you want to do it, your comments and questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Wells, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. Thanks very much. I mentioned that Spencer Wells was visiting the campus in December, in early December, and he was going to be on the program then, and I got sidelined by a cold, and we didn't do it, but we're glad that you could spend some time talking with us this way.
Well, it's good to be here.
This is something, you know, these questions are indeed questions that have preoccupied scientists for some time, and going back before we knew about DNA and that we were able to use that. We were trying to answer the question, and at that point, what we had was fossils of extinct prehumans or of our human ancestors. And you know, we did what we could with that, but certainly there were significant limitations. So maybe we'd start out by talking not so much about where the science is now, but where the science was before DNA and how anthropologists tried to answer these very same questions.
Sure. Yeah, as you said, historically, people made use of the only data that they had at hand, and that was largely fossils. The study of paleoanthropology, digging potential human ancestors up out of the ground and basically looking at their morphology, the shape, often the skull shape, and guessing at which one we might be related to, which one might be our ancestor. And that's been going on for a couple of hundred years, so the famous Neanderthal find in the 1850s, and then all the work that was done in Africa by the Leakey family in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and work that was done by Eugène Dubois in Java, Southeast Asia in the 1890s, and so on. And basically, we had a very muddy picture of where came from. In fact, some of the earliest fossils were not found in Africa. They were found outside of Africa, at least ones of our own species, until the Omo-Kabish find, which was discovered by Richard Leakey in the 1960s, was redated to 195,000 years ago. And that only happened in the last decade or so. So, you know, the fossil record certainly tells us something about potential ancestors, but it doesn't tell us about that direct line of descent that leads from the past down to us. We don't know if these fossils left descendants, whereas we know that our genes came from somewhere. They came from our ancestors. And so that's why the genetic approach really kind of came to the fore in the study of human origins.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is where we have to at least give people the rudiments of genetic science, and where for some people, and I would include myself, it starts to get kind of confusing, not being much of a biologist. But maybe here you can just talk about the basic idea by looking at the DNA of living people now, how it is actually possible to trace back, to step back, and to say something about who all the people were that were there, all their forefathers and foremothers.
Well, it's really pretty simple, David. As I said, we know that we got our DNA from our parents, and they got their DNA from their parents, and so on. So it traces an unbroken lineage back in time through our ancestry. Now, DNA is like a blueprint to make another version of you, and there's a lot of information in that blueprint. There are 6 billion letters of code in your genome, the A's, C's, G's, and T's that make up our genetic code. And that's a lot of information to copy in every generation and pass on. And it's, you know, compare it to copying a long text that you might read. So War and Peace, but multiply it by 100. Imagine copying that by hand in every generation. What's going to happen? You're inevitably going to make a typo, no matter how careful you are. And that happens at the genetic level as well. We have between 50 and 100 changes per transmission event. So in every generation when it's being copied, we get around 100 random typos that are introduced into the genetic code. And most of these have absolutely no effect. They're simply baggage that gets passed on through the generations. And these are what we call genetic markers. And if you share a genetic marker with another person, it means you share an ancestor, that person who first had that change in their DNA all those generations ago. And that's how we can connect people up into branches of the human family tree, by looking at the patterns of these genetic markers.
Mm. And how then, you know, I talked about the fact that one of the big questions that people have been thinking about for a long time, and again, certainly back before we knew anything about DNA, was where and when did the human species, particularly the modern version of humans, the Homo sapiens, the us, where and when did that start? Where did these first people first appear? And this provides us with really an answer to both of those questions.
It does. I mean, we still rely on the fossil record to talk about the origin of our species. The genetic data isn't necessarily going to tell you about the exact date we became humans. So, again, those Omo-Kabish finds from Ethiopia dating to 195,000 years ago, that's the first time we see things in the fossil record that are definitively Homo sapiens. And so that happened in Africa. And there was another event that probably occurred around 70 to 80,000 years ago, where we went through a change in behavior, the dawn of the late Stone Age, as it's called in Africa, or the Upper Paleolithic, as it's called outside of Africa. Tool styles become much more refined. Art makes its appearance around that time, and the hunting methods become much better. So we become behaviorally modern around that time. Now, the question is, when do we start to leave Africa to populate the rest of the world? And that's where the genetic data really comes in. And it shows us that we were all still living only in Africa as a species. We were limited entirely to that continent until around 60,000 years ago. So it's only in the last 60,000 years, which is only about 2,000 human generations, that we've scattered to the wind, populated the world, increased in number to, you know, nearly 7 billion today and growing, and generated the language diversity that we see around the world, and the physical diversity, and so on. So that's really the most surprising thing that the genetic data gives us, is this idea that instead of spreading over the world over millions of years or even hundreds of thousands of years, it's happened over the course of tens of thousands of years.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest, Spencer Wells. He is a population geneticist. He's an anthropologist. He is explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, and he heads the Genographic Project since 2005. This is a project which involves both the Geographic Society, IBM, has been looking at DNA samples, going all around the world collecting DNA samples, trying to, again, put together this as detailed a picture as possible of the human family tree, to ask some questions about how everything everybody, how certainly all of the people who are alive today are related, but how they are related to the people that came before, and to trace it back as far as we could possibly trace it back, to learn about human origins, where the modern human species began, and then how from that point it moved out, and eventually, and we end up with people living everywhere. If you're interested in reading about this, you might take a look at his book, Deep Ancestry Inside the Genographic Project, published in 2006. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, just again, to make things more a little bit more complicated, there are particular kinds of genetic indicators. There are really two that have been looked at to try to generate this kind of understanding. There was one that essentially it's something that we get from our mothers, and then there was one that we get from our fathers. And these have been used to tell us two really different things, answers to two different kinds of questions that we're interested in. One is this question about, you know, who is our oldest relative? How far back are we talking? And that's the kind of thing that some years back got a lot of attention in the media. And then there's also this question of, well, when at what point did people from that point of origin start moving out? So maybe talk a little bit some more about how it is we arrived at this this idea that we are all descended from an individual, a woman. We have a woman who is the mother of all of us. That does indeed go back, well, something in the vicinity of 200,000 years to Africa.
Sure. Yeah, so you're talking about mitochondrial DNA in the case of the female lineage, and this is a piece of DNA that is outside of what we think of as the genome proper. There's 23 pairs of chromosomes inside the cell nucleus. It's actually a little inside a little organelle, a little cellular structure out in the cytoplasm of the cell. And it is passed on, as I said, from mother to child. So men are carrying it, but they don't pass it on. So it tells you about your mother's 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 mother, all the way back to the very first mother. And so this allows us to see back to the very early days of our species. As you said, it goes back to a woman who lived around 200,000 years ago in Africa. And she is the maternal ancestor of everybody alive today. Now, she wasn't the only woman alive at that time. There were obviously other people living in the population. But she was the lucky one who left that mitochondrial DNA lineage down to the present day. And it's diversified over time. And it tells us a story of human migration in the same way that the male equivalent does, which you mentioned, the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is actually inside the cell nucleus, part of what you think of as the genome. And it is the little piece of DNA that makes men men. And that's essentially what it does. It codes for some secondary sexual characteristics as well, but basically it determines sex. So if you have a Y chromosome, you're a man, and obviously only men are passing it on to their sons. So it tells you about your father's 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 father. Hmm. Now, it doesn't go back quite as far. It goes back to somewhere between 60 and 90,000 years ago, also in Africa. So both pieces of DNA definitively showing that we all trace our ancestry back to Africa. The reason it doesn't go back as far is probably due to traditional mating practices. You look around the world, and in most societies, a few men get to mate a lot. They have a lot of kids, and some men don't have very many kids or have none at all. And most women, on the other hand, do get a chance to reproduce. So the effective population size of males is lower in most populations. It's as though there were fewer men than women. And what this means is that we lose lineages more quickly in that scenario, and we can't go back as far. So the Y chromosome doesn't take us quite as far back, but it does take us back to Africa. And it shows very definitively that we only started to leave Africa, as I said before, around 60,000 years ago.
Yeah. So that also invites this interesting question. Well, if modern humans go back to 200,000 years and they were living there in Africa, why, and apparently things must have been fine, must have been good enough so that they stayed where they were for quite a long period of time until this point around 60,000 years when they moved out. And then, you know, as you have done, and we can talk some more about this, branched out in various sorts of directions until they go to the east. They go to end up in Europe and so forth. So then you have to ask this question, well, what was happening 60,000 years ago that might have prompted these people who had been in basically in one place for a long period of time to leave?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we don't know for sure, but we have a working hypothesis. And the short answer is it was a population expansion that drove them. So the population size in Africa was actually increasing beginning around that time, and some people started to leave, probably as a result of this expanding population, looking for additional resources outside of Africa. Now, this was a rather unusual population expansion because we were actually coming back from a near extinction event. Between 70 and 75,000 years ago, roughly, the human population dropped down to as few as 2,000 people. That's the total number of human beings alive at that time. We were hanging on by our fingernails on the brink of extinction. And the reason for that is probably due to a couple of major climatic events. Number one, we were in the grip of the last ice age, which had started roughly 120,000 years ago, but it kind of bounced around at the beginning, and it really started to get cold around 70, 75,000 years ago. So that's a major downturn in the climate, which had a very drying effect on Africa, a desiccating effect. So it started to dry out. A lot of Africa started turning to desert. Now, around that same time, we also had the eruption of a massive volcano in Sumatra, Mount Toba, the largest volcanic eruption of the last 2 million years. And it spewed ash and sulfur dioxide and so on up into the upper atmosphere. And it created a global kind of nuclear winter effect, which added to the effects of the ice age. And so that kind of climatic double whammy really slammed the early human population. And in order to survive this, you know, intense climatic onslaught, we had to become smarter, more innovative. And so that's when we start to see the appearance of those modern behaviors that I mentioned before. And once the climate started to shift a little bit, got a little bit better, the population literally started to expand. And so that's probably what led us out of Africa around 60,000 years ago. Mm.
But I just for a second, and I've got some callers here I want to get to. I want to come back to the point that you mentioned, and some people, you know, maybe if they blinked, they might have missed that in fact, at this time that we're talking about, things were really bad for early humans, and that at one point we think that it was maybe about 2,000 people. That's all the early humans we had, and that there, if things had been maybe just a little bit worse, we might not be here.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, climate shifts have played a huge role in hominid evolution over time. They played a role around 5 million years ago when we started walking upright. There was a drying period that led to the expansion of the savannas at the expense of the forests in Africa, and so it opened up a new ecosystem and people started walking upright out in the savannas. There was another major climatic shift, another drying event around 2 million years ago when Homo erectus appears on the scene, and the brains became bigger and tools were developed and so on. And then, of course, there's this major shift around 70,000 years ago when we become behaviorally modern. And so, you know, these crisis events lead to innovations in the hominid line.
We have some callers here. We'll take them in the order they came in. We'll start with St. Charles, and this is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I was curious, which way do you think that the population is going now? Do you think it's we'll overpopulate this planet and sooner than later? And the other thing is, too, I know you were talking about Africa. Isn't it true that all the plates, all the land masses were all clumped together as one in the middle of the Earth?
Okay, I'll take the second part first. Certainly the continents are moving around due to plate tectonics, as it's called, but over the time span that we're talking about during, you know, the last 200,000 years, they were pretty much in the same place they are today, so that didn't play a huge role. Africa is the most tropical continent on Earth. 85% of it is in the tropics. And so it gets a lot of sunlight, and basically the sort of ecosystem you have any place in Africa is largely determined by the amount of rainfall you get. It can vary from desert to the lush tropical forests in places like Congo. So, you know, those ecosystems can shift very quickly simply by changing the amount of rainfall. And so that's part of the reason we think that Africa has kind of spawned all of these hominid lines over time, is that you have all these different ecosystems that you can have individuals moving in and out of. The first part, are we leading to overpopulation? Is the population growing too quickly or whatever it might be? Yeah, I think we certainly are. If you think about people living a Western lifestyle, an American lifestyle, you know, driving SUVs and, you know, all the factory food and so on, you know, I think we're certainly taking too many resources from the planet to support 10 billion people. 9 to 10 billion is the UN projection by the middle of this century. And I actually touch on this in my book that's coming out. You mentioned it before, Pandora's Seed, coming out in June. So, yeah, I think that certainly this is going to be another crisis event that's going to lead to innovations. And I think certainly green energy is something that's on everybody's minds right now, but I think shifts in the way we produce our food are also on the horizon.
All right. The lines are full. I hope the caller won't mind if I go on and take the next person, and that's someone in Effingham. So we'll go there, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm thinking of life and the progress of the program, and I missed a few minutes, but have you touched on the origins of life in water? And that's where it all came from, and the so-called human, and everything ends in man, and I have a great dispute with that. Men were not the first. If I'm understanding properly, the mother, who was mother and father both, in the water, produced from that environment and got out of the water and began to develop there, had to go back to the water, and in and out until they could live on land, and we all still have to drink water in order to survive. And I'm wondering if you have studied or can answer the process by which we evolved all life out of water. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Well, that's going back a little further than we had been. I don't know if that's something you can talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about it briefly. It's certainly not something that we study in the Genographic Project or in my own work. It's a little bit earlier, as you say. But no, I mean, the evidence is that probably life was created in a wet environment, probably on the edge of water. But certainly water played a role because it's ubiquitous throughout the animal and plant kingdoms. You know, you need water to produce life. And beyond that, you know, we don't really know exactly how it started. Some people believe that clays kind of self-organized organic molecules into things that could begin to replicate themselves. And, you know, over time you tinker with that and you make slight improvements, and that gives those organisms, if you will call them that, an advantage. And so they take over and they have additional improvements, and ultimately you end up with things like us at the end, and everything that we see around us in the world today that's alive. Beyond that, I can't really say that much, apart from reiterating that, yes, as the caller said, water is critical to life.
Let me ask you a different question, and that is regarding the possibility of capturing some DNA from no longer extant humans. And the project that you're involved in collects DNA from living people, and then we're using that, putting that together to form this data bank and then tracing back. And I'm sure that anthropologists and paleontologists and all scientists would think that it would be a stunningly, amazingly wonderful thing if, for example, you had some DNA from a Neanderthal. Well, what we have of a lot of these prehumans is we have fossils, we have skulls and other kinds of bones. Does anybody think that it might be possible to try from any of these extinct prehumans or early humans or early these hominids that we could possibly get any kind of a DNA that we could look at?
The answer is yes. In fact, it's been done. Back in 1996, a team led by Svante Paabo, who's in Leipzig in Germany, the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology now, was able to sequence DNA, mitochondrial DNA, from a Neanderthal, in fact, the original Neanderthal skeleton that was discovered. And they got enough sequence data to be able to show that Neanderthals, number one, were not our ancestors. They were distant cousins. We share an ancestor around 500,000 years ago with Neanderthals back in Africa, but they're not the direct ancestors of present-day Europeans. So in some cases, the DNA is preserved for as long as 40, 50,000 years. If it's kept cold and dry, if the bones have been extremely well-preserved, it is possible in some instances to get DNA out and to be able to sequence it. In fact, we have a center set up studying ancient DNA, as it's called, in Australia. Alan Cooper is our principal investigator, and we are primarily focusing on modern humans, Homo sapiens, looking at things like cultural transition. So as agriculture moved into Europe, do we see a shift in the source of genetic lineages in European populations? We've got some very interesting publications coming through on the ancient DNA side, and it's a fantastic technique, and it's really progressed in the last decade. You know, it used to be very hit or miss and very difficult to disentangle modern contaminating DNA from real ancient material. And now there are techniques that allow you to bias in favor of the ancient material, and it's becoming really applicable to these sorts of studies. And I think very, very important, a very important adjunct to our studies of modern humans.
So one of the things that you talked about a little bit earlier about that, certainly before there was DNA, we had fossil evidence. And so people had the fossils and they tried to arrange them and they tried to look at what they looked like and how they thought things changed over time and how they were alike or not alike modern humans. And so they tried to assemble these trees. And they had these individuals, and they gave them names, and they tried to say, all right, this individual is related to this individual, and this is older than this one, to try to talk about how it is we get from there to here. But a lot of that was, it was maybe informed guessing. If you can, in fact, look at DNA, does that actually help you better look at the fossil record and make some determinations about how it all fits together?
Well, absolutely, yeah. If you can get DNA out of this fossil material, it adds a very important bit of information to your study of those fossils. It can tell you, you know, are these things the same species or are they different? This would be important, for instance, with the finds that they discovered recently in Flores, Homo floresiensis, or the hobbits, as they're called in the popular press. Big debate in the field, which I think most of the morphologists have now come down on the side that they are a new species. But it's certainly debatable. Are they a variety of Homo erectus? Could they be microcephalic modern humans? And, you know, that's the sort of thing that the DNA evidence could really solve definitively. Unfortunately, for most of the fossil record, we're talking about, you know, dates that are way in excess of what we can get DNA from, so millions of years. DNA is not going to stick around that long, certainly the way that these things were preserved. But over the span of, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, even 1,000 years, we can get DNA out in some cases, and it adds a very important piece to the puzzle.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Spencer Wells, is a population geneticist. He is explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, and since 2005 he has headed the Genographic Project. This is something that's a joint effort of the National Geographic Society, IBM, and the Wyatt Family Foundation. And what they have been doing over that time is collecting and analyzing DNA samples from all over the world, taking a look at what you can find about human beings and where they came from, how it is they spread out from their point of origin in Africa, when that happened, how that happened. And a lot of this is recorded in a book that he's written. It's titled Deep Ancestry Inside the Genographic Project, published by National Geographic in 2006. And if you're interested in reading some more on the subject, you can look at that. And the Genographic Project does indeed have a website, so if you want to find out more about that, you can do that. And I think, aren't you kind of coming to the end of the effort?
Well, we're thinking about transitioning into the next phase of the project, which is going to happen sometime in the middle of next year, where we wrap up the lion's share of the sampling globally and the initial genotyping and the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA, and we really focus on the analysis and perhaps looking at additional pieces of DNA in the rest of the genome. It's going to be wrapping up toward the middle of next year. But anybody who's interested can go onto the website, as you said, nationalgeographic.com/genographic, find out more about the project, and you can actually get your own DNA tested. You can order a kit and become a part of the effort.
All right. We have other questions. 333-9455 is Champaign Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk. At illinois.edu. We'll go on and talk next with someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, thank you. So the most interesting thing I've read on why humans initially left Africa was this was mechanism termed the Saharan pump. And I guess the long and short, it was in Scientific American about 15, 20 years ago. And I guess the short of it was that as long as the Sahara Desert exists on a large scale, humans really couldn't get out of Africa into Asia. But I guess it's a known fact that the Sahara has been temperate, that it has shrunk to almost nothing, and trees and savanna existed there. And, of course, humans would have moved into it and populated it. But then as it started to dry out again, always from the center it dries out, it pushed people in all different directions. Some, of course, got pushed back to where they came from. Others got pushed to the north coast, and some got pushed into Asia, and that this has happened numerous times, and that that is sort of the mechanism by which people repeatedly ended up moving out of Africa. I was wondering what your knowledge of that was. I found it very interesting when I read it years ago.
Absolutely. The Saharan pump has been, I think, vitally important in allowing humans to cross that huge barrier, you know, 1,000 miles of sand sea, particularly if you're living as a hunter-gatherer, is a pretty formidable barrier to migration. What's interesting is that even though you've had exoduses from Africa before, as you said, even if modern humans, Homo sapiens, around 110,000 years ago, people appear in the Middle East, nobody really got a proper foothold in Asia, and the people who were living in the Middle East 110,000 years ago disappeared after 80,000 years ago. They were actually replaced by Neanderthals. So it's only when you get behaviorally modern humans exiting Africa into Asia that you really see the expansion of humans proper around the world. So, you know, although the Saharan pump has allowed people multiple times, or ancestors multiple times, to leave, including the ancestors of the Neanderthals and Homo erectus as well, it hasn't alone accounted for the expansion around the planet. It's this change in behavior probably that gave us the abilities to adapt culturally very rapidly as we moved around the world. There was also probably an early migration out of Africa via the Horn of Africa, across the Bab el-Mandab Strait to Yemen, present-day Yemen. And so these would have been people following a coastal route. And so for them, the Sahara wasn't a barrier at all. They were simply living on the coast, living on coastal resources like shellfish and perhaps trapping fish. So that's probably the very first exodus of modern humans from Africa around 60,000 years ago. And then you probably had a second one between 45 and 50,000 that did come across the Sahara.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's then go on, because I do have a number of people. The lines are all full. And next, talk with someone in Belgium, line number three. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. You've broached the topic of Neanderthal here a couple times, and you're talking about these migrations in and out of Africa several times. Now, how do you come across the thought that, how can I put this in certain words? We leave and we occupy certain portions of the earth, and we start with Neanderthals or Homo erectus or whatever ones you want to talk about, and we shrink back into Africa, and then we come back out. But yet you say the Neanderthals are not directly related to us, and the Homo erectus aren't exactly directly related to us. Well, each time we go out of Africa, surely we must have interacted with these other partially related groups. What effect have they had to our genome? Now, you say they're not exactly us, but there's every possibility we could have had some interactions that could have affected our genetic composition.
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly a possibility. We don't see evidence for it at the genetic level. Again, everybody traces back to Africa within the last 60,000 years or so. So there are no lineages that we see in Asia that seem to have come from Homo erectus a million years ago. But what possibly happened was you had expansions out of Africa. You also have back migrations from Asia into Africa, and we see evidence of that even in the lifetime of our own species, very clear genetic evidence. When you have these events that where the Sahara becomes a grassland rather than a desert. So it's possible that you could have had something like Homo erectus leaving Africa around 1.8 million years ago, which is when the fossil evidence suggests they did leave, and then back migrations in, say, a million years ago, and perhaps those individuals, probably still erectus, could have evolved into our ancestors, so Homo heidelbergensis and ultimately Homo sapiens. So it's possible that you could have had this back and forth. What doesn't seem to have happened is when you had an exodus of a later species, so you had heidelbergensis leaving, becoming Neanderthals, when we encountered Neanderthals in Europe, for instance, around 35,000 years ago, there doesn't seem to have been any interbreeding, as far as we can tell at the moment. We certainly see no genetic evidence for it. And the same with Homo erectus. We probably encountered them in Southeast Asia when we were migrating through around 50,000 to 60,000 years ago, and there's no genetic evidence that we interbred with them. There might have been a barrier to admixture to breeding. Maybe they just found them unattractive. Who knows? But there's no evidence that they are partially our ancestors in that sense.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll continue and next go to Bloomington, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hi. When you say that one bone is 200,000 years old and another skull is 160,000 years old, you talk as if those ages are certain, you know, as if you've got them nailed, as if you're sure about the dates. But I have heard testimonies of people who have tried to determine the dates. These dates were mostly determined by radioactive decay. And they would submit a sample for dating, which they had just removed from a volcanic site. In other words, this was fresh volcanic material from a volcanic flow. In other words, the date should be zero. And so they submit this volcanic material for dating. They'll usually submit it to two laboratories, more than one laboratory. The dates will come back vastly different from the two laboratories. One laboratory will find, for example, that the sample is 100,000 years old. The other laboratory will say, no, it's only 50,000 years old. But it's actually 0 years old. They got it from a fresh volcanic site. Can you explain these very different and false dates coming from different laboratories?
The short answer is no. I don't know about the particular scenario that you're talking about. Certainly, all dating methods have confidence intervals, error bars. So it would be 72,000 years plus or minus, say, 6,300 years. So it's never exact, even with carbon dating, which is very, very precise, going back to around 25 or 30,000 years ago, and then starts to lose its power a bit.
Yeah, but beyond that, it's not reliable.
Right, and then you use things like potassium-argon dating and electron spin resonance, and those have even, you know, broader error bars. So, you know, it's never absolutely precise. You can't get, you know, September 11th minus 10,322. You know, you can't get that sort of a date, but it's plus or minus, you know, a certain number of years, and that varies according to the method that you're using. You know, and in some cases, you're not testing the material itself. You're testing the surrounding material. As you said, a lot of the time in Africa, it's volcanic ash. So you're giving a, you know, a lower bound for the age or an upper bound for the age based on the position of the fossil in the sediments. And that has some error associated with it as well. So it's certainly not precise, and this is, you know, part of the reason why genetics is important, because we don't rely on those sorts of methods.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we are moving into about our last 10, 15 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Just let me very quickly, again, introduce the guest, Spencer Wells. He's a population geneticist, anthropologist, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, and also heads up the Genographic Project that's got underway in 2005, this effort to look at DNA samples from living people all around the world to try to create a kind of a map, a family tree that shows how people are related, and also to try to provide some answers to the questions, where did modern humans begin? When did they begin? If we say they begin at a particular place, like we say that they begin in Africa, then how is it that they moved out from there and eventually populated the rest of the world? There is a website of the Genographic Project. You can take a look at that if you're interested. And even participating, you can do that as well. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. And let me just do that. Let me get in an email, because we did have someone with a question who was interested in I think actually I have a couple of here. What the thinking now is about where Native Americans came from, what their origins were.
Okay, yeah, the genetic evidence is very clear on that. They come from Asia, probably somewhere in central Siberia, maybe around the Altai Mountains that are just to the west of Mongolia. And the initial wave came from that region. People walked across the Bering Land Bridge that existed during the last glacial maximum, which was around 16,000 years ago. So they came in within the last 20,000 years and spread very rapidly down to South America. And then there appears to have been a second migration, possibly a third, but certainly a second migration that came along the coast between 6,000 and perhaps 8,000 years ago. And these are people who would have been in boats, kayaks, presumably, like the Eskimos use today. And they just migrated down the western side of North America, don't seem to have really made it down into South America. There was possibly a third migration across the north, the Inuits, the ancestors of, say, the people living in Greenland, the natives of Greenland, who came across also from Asia. But all of the migrations seem to have been from Asia within the last 20,000 years.
All right. To Bloomington, Illinois, next. Line one. Hello.
Yes, I have a few questions. One, now, out of this group of 2,000 people, like 60,000 years ago, what groups all came out of that? I mean, did the Aborigines come out of that? Did the Cro-Magnon come out of that group? Apparently not the Neanderthal from what you were saying, but did also come from that group, the different varieties of black people in Africa? I'm thinking, you know, the Pygmies, the Hottentots, and so forth. Did, you know, which people came out of that group of 2,000? And, you know, were there other groups of people alive at that point? Now, what sense did the modern group come out of that group of 2,000? Would that be the Semitic races and Indo-Europeans?
Every person alive today is a descendant of that group, that small group of people living only in Africa. And there were separate populations in Africa. There were people living in the south and people living in the northeast and possibly people living in the interior. And so the sum total of all of those people would have been roughly 2,000. So, you know, it was a pretty small group. And as I said, everybody alive today, including all of the groups that you mentioned, Australian Aborigines, Native Americans, modern Europeans, and so on, all came from that group. We're all descendants of that very small group of humans.
Well, let me get another email question here because I think it sort of fits. And we have someone who writes in this question. The listener says, I realize that race as we think of it today is almost more of a political concept than a scientific one. But he says, I'm curious to what extent these migrations that we've talked about contributed to the creation of what we regard as races.
Well, certainly people have adapted to the environments as we moved around the world. So we evolved in, as I said, the most tropical continent on Earth, Africa. There's a lot of sunlight striking the ground in Africa. We're living out in the savannas, not a lot of trees around, and we're out hunting a lot of the time. We're gathering. And so we need a natural sunscreen to protect our skin. We didn't have SPF 50 to slather on back in those days. So we had darker skin. We had melanin, which is our natural sunscreen. And so our ancestors were dark-skinned. And as we left Africa and moved to higher latitudes, there was less sunlight striking our skin. It was cold. We were wearing clothing, furs, and so on to keep warm. And so it turns out we actually had to lose some of that pigmentation because you have to allow some sunlight through to the deeper layers of your skin to biosynthesize vitamin D, which most people don't normally get in their diets, the reason it's supplemented in milk and other things today. So in order to provide that vitamin D, we had to lose some of the pigmentation. So people in northern latitudes tend to have lighter skin than people living around the tropics. So in the same way that, you know, skin color change, facial appearance might have adapted, and other attributes that we think of as defining race today, but it's largely changes that have occurred relatively recently in the last 50,000 years or so. And a lot of it, as I said, has been adaptation to the different ecosystems that we live in.
All right. Let's again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I hope you'll forgive me because I've got a number of emails here, a number of callers, and we got just about 5-6 minutes. So I want to go next to someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Yes. I have two questions about our cousins, the Neanderthal. I recently read, I think it was in Science magazine, that at the close of the last ice age, in that latter period, there may have been only 5,000 to 10,000 Neanderthal in Europe. Does this seem reasonable?
It's difficult to make that estimate. I mean, ordinarily, for modern human populations, we would use a genetic method. We'd look at the level of genetic variation, mm-hmm. and we could estimate the effective population size.
I think they were.
No, they really couldn't have been because we only have a handful of Neanderthals.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it would largely be based on the fossil evidence, and, you know, if that's what the paleontologists say, I have to, you know, take them at their word and believe them. It certainly sounds reasonable to me. It might have been even fewer. You know, they eventually dwindled down to none, so, mm-hmm. you know, at some point there were very few of them around.
At that point, wouldn't it have been very difficult to maintain a healthy genetic variability?
Yeah, and people think that that probably contributed to the extinction of the Neanderthals, that the groups became so sparse and spread out that effectively there was no breeding population, and so that contributed to their demise.
I have a second question. It has to do with the DNA. Apparently they recovered some DNA fairly recently, I believe from a tooth of one of the very latest of the Neanderthals in the Gibraltar area.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the portion of the code that governs the speech mechanism was almost identical to that of modern man.
You're talking about the FOXP2 gene?
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yes, absolutely. I actually write about this in my latest book.
Oh, I'll have to read it.
It does appear to be the modern human form. It's not exactly like ours, but the protein coding part is pretty much identical to ours. And so to the extent that that gene modulates human speech, and it certainly seems to be necessary, although not sufficient probably for speech, yes, they had the ability perhaps to make some of the same sounds that we do. And they probably did have, you know, a rudimentary form of speech. They certainly had a hyoid bone, which is that little bone that creates your Adam's apple that allows you to modulate sounds in your throat. They had a modern human hyoid bone as well. So they probably did have some basic form of speech. It probably wasn't fully modern syntactic speech, subject, verb, object, that we use to convey very complex ideas. It was probably relatively simple in its structure. Simply because they don't appear to have been very good innovators. Their tool styles that they were using in Europe at 30,000 years ago were very similar to tool styles that had been used for, you know, the previous 100,000 years or so. And they certainly don't seem to have developed the bow and arrow and so on. Their hunting methods were relatively basic compared to ours. They would stand behind trees and jump out and stab a spear into something, typically, whereas we were better at hunting over long distances in large groups out in the grasslands. So, they probably have the ability to produce some spoken sounds, but they probably didn't have a very complex language.
All right. I want to thank the caller again. I have somebody who's been patient here in Carlock, so I want to get to them. Line number three. Hello.
Hello. Do you believe that the human species is the only species of human being, of mammals that breeds itself into different classes, that is just as artificial as a race? And that the communists would never be able to achieve their goal of a class of society by economic, social, or political methods. They'd have to go back to genetic. I know it sounds absurd to suggest it. I just wondered how you'd deal with that.
Interesting. Ape societies certainly do have something akin to class in that there are dominant members and subordinate members. So to the extent that that is what you're talking about, we don't seem to be the only mammal that has that sort of a breeding structure. And other species are similar in that respect. As for the other stuff, I can't really speculate on that. It's really verging on philosophy and politics, and it's not really something I can address. But I don't think that it's something innate in us to want to create an overclass and an underclass.
All right. We just have about 5 minutes left. I have a couple of emails here I'd like to try to get in. We have someone who was wondering what population geneticists have to say about the theory of an Aryan invasion of India.
There seems to be some evidence for a migration from the Central Asian steppes within the last few thousand years, and we're trying to narrow down exactly when that might have occurred. And these could have been people speaking early Indo-European languages who are known to the old school of anthropologists as the Aryans, not equated with the Germanic peoples at all. They probably originated somewhere in the steppe zone of southern Russia or Ukraine. And to the extent that the genetic patterns are there, it suggests that there might have been an invasion of Indo-European speakers, you know, roughly at the time the Rig Veda would say that they invaded, around 1500 BC. So it's possible that there may be some genetic evidence for that, but we're still doing the analysis.
And another listener writes, Will, who apparently has children who were adopted from China. He says, will my children adopted from China be able to trace their family sometime in the future?
Yes, absolutely. Definitely. So you could order one of our kits, and that would give you a start. And then there are genealogical forums online where you can take your data and opt into those and attach a name or an email address to it and start looking for matches and maybe find long-lost cousins. Mm.
Well, something that I want to make sure we at least deal with here in the couple of minutes we have left, the kind of work here that you're doing, particularly the interest in collecting genetic material from indigenous people, has been somewhat controversial because there have been a lot of arguments and concern about the issue of ownership and exploitation of that, just as the way the resources of indigenous people have been exploited in the past. How are you trying to deal with that kind of criticism? And in fact, have you gotten that kind of criticism?
In some cases, we have, largely in areas where there's a history of particularly nasty colonial exploitation. So that would include North America and Australia, to a certain extent, some places in South America. And it's understandable, given the history in these areas and given what's been done to these indigenous groups, ever since Europeans colonized, and largely Europeans are responsible for this. So, you know, we take this very seriously, and we do a lot of outreach with indigenous groups, and we feel that when people donate a sample to the project, we're entering into a contract with them, and we're only going to be looking at certain genetic markers. We're not going to be scanning the entire genome, and, you know, we're not going to be looking at things that are medically relevant that might be patented by a third party at some point in the future. You know, we do not want to have this seen as an exploitative relationship at all. We feel, again, that, you know, this is a collaboration with indigenous groups around the world. So, I think these are very important issues, and they're issues that we've thought about long and hard, and we feel that we're doing things in the most ethically sound way we possibly can.
Yeah, the Genographic Project, we should say, is a non-profit and not-for-profit effort. Is it, though, possible that it might turn up something that could be, that could have some kind of profit implications?
Not really, because, again, we're not looking at those markers that might yield some sort of diagnostic test for medical condition or, drug response or something like that you can imagine a company developing a product around. These are simply markers that tell us about your ancestry.
I did mention, I think at least one time, maybe you also mentioned, too, that you have a book that will be coming out soon. I think last I saw was maybe June. Pandora's Seed, the subtitle of the book apparently is The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. What is the theme of Pandora's Seed?
Well, I kind of call it a work of demographic philosophy. The idea is that our ancestors developed farming, agriculture, around 10,000 years ago at several places around the world simultaneously. And it's led to a massive population increase. It's also led to the expansion of lots of diseases, both infectious and chronic diseases more recently. And so there have been a lot of knock-on effects, unintended consequences of developing agriculture. And so the book examines why we would have developed it in the first place. And it turns out that the early farmers were actually less healthy and lived shorter lives than the surrounding hunter-gatherer groups. You have to ask yourself, why would people ever do this to themselves? And the answer to that is that there was yet another climatic crisis, something called the Younger Dryas at the end of the last ice age, where it plunged the population back into ice age-like conditions for about 1,700 years. And we had to develop agriculture to survive. The population had already gotten too big for us to survive as hunter-gatherers during the ice age conditions again. And so it was out of necessity that we developed this, and then when the climate improved, the population explodes. And, of course, we went from, you know, 5 to perhaps 10 million people around 10,000 years ago to the billions that we have on Earth today. And so I basically look at the long-term consequences of developing agriculture.
We have to stop there. Perhaps this summer when the book comes out, we can talk again.
That'd be great.
But for now, we'll have to say our thanks to our guest, Spencer Wells. He's explorer-in-residence and leader of the Genographic, explorer-in-residence at National Geographic Society, and leads the Genographic Project. You can go to the website and look at that and find out more about that. You also might want to take a look at his book, Deep Ancestry, Inside the Genographic Project, published by National Geographic in 2006.